This episode is brought to you in part by the Acceleron BioAg brand. Harness powerful crop solutions using technology derived from nature. Products from the Acceleron BioAg brand are bioenhancers, primarily containing live microbial organisms. The products help promote increased nutrient and water availability for better yield potential. Acceleron BioAg product offerings are available for canola, wheat, corn, soybean, pulses, and more. Visit AcceleronBioAg.ca for product information and to view BioAdvantage trial results from growers like you. Nature, it's powerful technology. Always read and follow label directions. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. To start off this week, congratulations! We've reached the arbitrary point in the Earth's orbit around the sun where another year has passed, and it's time to think about renewal, revival, and our first topic this week, regeneration. When we say regenerative agriculture, we mean the school of farm management in which the farmer levels up from just sustainability and looks to build up his or her land rather than just take food crops and cattle fuel from it. Now, depending where you are, the topic may have loomed large on the summer farm tour circuit this year, wherever they discussed, say, adaptive grazing or cover crops and or integrating livestock into a cash cropping system. The Manitoba Forage and Grassland Association made it the overarching topic of a conference it held in late November in Brandon. Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator sat in on that conference, and she joins us now. Alexis, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Hi, Dave. Great to be here.
So here we have a conference on regenerative ag, hosted by a forage and pasture organization. Seems only natural, so to speak, since much of what we hear seems to revolve around using livestock to cycle nutrients back onto the land.
Yeah, you know, that's certainly a topic that you hear a lot, and certainly a topic that anyone who, like you alluded to, has been around the farm tour circuit in the last couple of years. That being said, we should also remember that a number of other sectors, most notably maybe the organic sector, is very much a driving part of this conversation, and they were certainly out in force at this event as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to regenerative ag, we know that results can vary, of course, from region to region, from soil zone to soil zone, or even from farm to farm. Can you give us an idea of the kind of results that some of the representative producers at this show have been seeing from practices such as, you mentioned, high-density rotational grazing and whatnot in your article on the subject?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the results that were mentioned are probably not a surprise to anyone who has attended any of these workshops or has heard any of these speakers speak before. And so certainly soil health is sort of an overarching topic among people who are champions of regenerative agriculture. And among that, you see, you know, increased organic matter, you see better nutrient cycling. In a lot of cases, water infiltration or erosion risk kind of comes into it, and they're seeing gains that way. And then, of course, for anyone who's been involved in the in talks around, you know, the carbon tax and that sort of thing, carbon sequestration certainly becomes part of this conversation. But the other aspect of this argument is on profit and efficiency and making sure that they're getting the most profit from those acres as possible while also being regenerative to the landscape. And one of the big things that I've been seeing and that I've been hearing from producers is this idea of reduced inputs. And one of the speakers at the conference, Dr. David Montgomery, maybe put it best, where he described a lot of the people who are doing regenerative agriculture as organic-ish, meaning that, you know, they're not organic, and certainly they keep those chemical tools available to them, but they're also pursuing all these other tools, you know, intercropping, cover cropping, that sort of thing, so that the inputs become sort of a last-ditch emergency-type measure. And because they're doing that, they're reducing the inputs and they're reducing their costs and therefore increasing their profit margins. And then, of course, in the livestock industry, you're hearing, you know, increased forage production. For those who are doing high stock density grazing, a lot of them are reporting that they're taking a lot more, or they're putting a lot more pounds per acre and therefore getting more profit that way. The last point I was going to make, that in mixed farming, in a lot of cases, they're using the different aspects of the farm to kind of support each other. So, for example, they might put a cover crop out after harvest to keep green cover on the landscape for, you know, erosion or weed reduction. But at the same time, they're using livestock to sort of recoup some of the costs because they're using that cover crop to graze and to feed that livestock.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand there was some discussion at this conference about whether livestock roaming your land is an absolute necessity if you're going to subscribe to the regenerative approach. I mean, it certainly sounds like it's they're a major mover in this, as you said.
They absolutely are, and especially in Manitoba, like you hear about rotational grazing and high density grazing in regards to regenerative agriculture a lot. That being said, like there was sort of an awareness that it's not just livestock producers who are driving this conversation, that, like I said, the organic sector is very much out in force. And in a lot of cases, it's just even conventional farmers who are annual cropping, but are wanting to look at different ways to improve their soil health and get more production. And so, like, there was this awareness that this regenerative agriculture movement is attracting farmers from all different strokes, and they're going to approach this movement in very different ways. And there's this wide toolbox that of practices that are involved in regenerative agriculture, and the producers kind of pick and choose what works for their circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, you've mentioned organic farming and organic-ish farming a couple of times here, and if we look strictly at the crop side, I mean, minimum till or zero till seems to make the most sense, at least from where I'm sitting here, in regenerative agriculture. You know, there's less erosion, there's more organic matter. So it sort of surprises me that there would be room for organic farmers in this regenerative umbrella if they have to till for weed control. Is there room? Obviously, there's more than enough room for people who are organic or organic-ish in their farming practices.
See, that's one of the very interesting things about the regenerative agriculture movement. And you're right, because in a lot of cases, a lot of these speakers and a lot of experts you talk to, they talk about, you know, parking the plow, and they make that a very big thing, that reducing tillage is very critical to some of this. But like you said, for the organic farmers, tillage is key to their operations. It's how they keep their weeds down. And so, like, I've talked to a lot of organic producers who are very interested in this regenerative agriculture movement. And the way they see it is they see tillage as sort of this necessary evil. They're almost seeing it the same way that these organic-ish farmers are looking at inputs, where they're keeping it in their back pocket, and it's certainly something that is involved in their operation, but they're turning to all these other tools first to try and find a way to reduce its use a little bit.
Well, we'll be looking forward to hearing more about this as meeting season gets underway in the next few weeks and months. And I'm also looking forward to hearing the term organic-ish become more widely accepted as well. And hopefully we can get an organic-ish sector going in this province, if not this country. Alexis, thanks very much for your time on Between the Rows.
Not a problem, Dave. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Alexis Stockford is a reporter for the Manitoba Cooperator. Shortly, we're going to hear from Ashley Robinson of CNS Canada with a look at the action and lack thereof in crop commodity markets. But first, we're turning east to Ontario. It's certainly no secret that this year's corn crop, particularly in western and southwestern Ontario, has turned up with critically high levels of vomitoxin thanks to rainfall and stifling humidity later in the summer. So now we have an Ontario corn crop with above average yields going at a deep discount, if it can be sold at all. John Greek is the editor of Farmtario, and he joins us now. John, welcome back to Between the Rows.
Thanks, Dave.
Now, let's put the corn quality picture in perspective first for listeners outside Ontario. How bad is this situation compared to a typical growing year in Ontario?
Well, it's significantly bad. It's the, you know, the worst crop that we can really remember as far as the amount of DON and vomitoxin in the crop. Grain farmers in Ontario thinks there could be a million acres affected in the province in some way, so it's definitely a significant issue here this year.
So growers down there have a crop that the livestock sector won't necessarily take for feed, and ethanol producers don't want it because the distillers' dried grains afterwards are even worse for that for the livestock sector. Is that correct?
That's yeah, that's true. That's the real crux of the marketing issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, there have been some commitments with respect to federal and provincial help for farmers to deal with infected corn, but first let's turn to the market picture. How are things right now for producers who have corn in some saleable condition?
So if corn's in good condition, there certainly is the usual markets for it, and it's being sold out as it usually would be. The trick is those that have the unsaleable corn or corn that is over, once you're over 5 parts per million, it's an issue, and then often if you are up to 8 parts per million Dawn, then the corn isn't even saleable in many cases. Although there are some elevators that are taking it, and there are some ethanol plants that have done runs at, and you could have brought them corn at any level of volumetoxin level, and they'd have run it through, just in order to make use of some of it.
Just to quantify that, what sort of discounts are we talking about here?
Right. So, if you are up in the kind of the 2 parts per million, then you start to get discounts, and you'll get up into 5, 7 parts per million. You're looking at $1 a bushel discount, and if you're up to 8, and if you got someone who'll take it, the discount is up around $2 a bushel. So, half the price of your corn is going out in discounts.
Mm-hmm. So, in this situation, what's a corn grower to do?
So there are several options. Some have been able to get it written off through the provincial crop insurance, AgriCorps. So some of the crops have been destroyed. Some of them in the fields that have destroyed it once they've harvested it. That hasn't been a high level amount yet. Other people are storing it. They're hoping then that some markets will open up, and there have been certainly some markets that have opened up that people have been able to get rid of some of that corn in 6 months or something. They have time into the next growing season if they have the storage room to store that corn, and then hope for some markets to send it out. Some of the ethanol plants continue to do some of these high volumetoxin runs, then you put it into that market, and there are a few other places where they can take it to. There's some people that are cleaning it and finding some ability to reduce that Dawn level when they clean it, although people have had some pretty mixed results there too, but some of them have been able to clean it and then they've been able to sell it into some markets.
Mm-hmm. Now, just for comparison purposes as well here, looking at nearby states such as Michigan, what's the situation like there? Is it even comparable to what's happening in Ontario right now?
Well, the infection level really isn't comparable in Michigan, although they've certainly had an above average problem in Michigan this year. There's no doubt about it. We greatly benefit here in Ontario from being in the lee of the Great Lakes always adequate rainfall usually in most of the province, and then in moderate winters but that also can mean we can have extra rainfall and extra humidity that are conditions that nobody else in North America really has a similar climate. But in Michigan they certainly had some of it, although they not as much there in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned before that some of the discounts that we're seeing in Ontario right now, those are actually caused by factors that in some ways actually even protect Ontario grain and oilseed growers. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, sure. Ontario growers often are able to get a better price for the corn than other nearby Midwest states, protected by the border and some of the options we have here in Ontario. We do have a fairly robust ethanol industry here that it takes about 30% of the corn crop, and that usually helps prop up some of the price here. And we feed a lot of animals, a lot of chickens, a lot of dairy cattle, some beef cattle, and a lot of pigs here in Ontario, and that also usually eats up a good chunk of our corn crops. So that usually helps. However, this year, the people that are feeding livestock need clean corn. People are making ethanol that are selling livestock feeds out the other end in form of the distillers' grains, need clean corn. So those two things that usually help support the price are also driving some of the greater discounts that we're having here in Ontario compared to some other nearby states.
Mm-hmm. And it's something we'll certainly be keeping an eye on in the near and farther future as the season progresses. John, thanks very much for coming on Between the Rows.
Thanks, Dave. Take care.
John Grigg is editor of Farmtario. Watch for more on this story in the next issue of Farmtario, which is due out next week. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Well, if you've been paying attention to U.S. news, or even if you've been trying not to, you likely know about the U.S. government's partial shutdown. U.S. President Donald Trump is in a standoff with Congress over funding support for one of the signature proposals on which he campaigned, the fortifying physical barriers along the U.S. southern border with Mexico. The shutdown has affected several U.S. government departments, including the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that in turn has several commodities, including ICE canola, in somewhat of a holding pattern as we come out of the Christmas holiday period. Ashley Robinson of Commodity News Service Canada is following that issue and others, and she joins us on the line. Ashley, welcome back to Between the Rows.
Thanks for having me.
So just to walk it back a bit here over the holidays, what was canola up to over the break?
Well, as you mentioned before, of course, there's the U.S. government shutdown. So mm-hmm. canola usually kind of falls along with the American commodity market, since canola is the only commodity market here north of the border. It kind of is influenced a lot by everything else that's going on in the world. And as everything in this world seems to go, the U.S. is the dominant force. So when it comes down to it, a lot of the time, canola just kind of plays follow the leader with the soy complex down there in Chicago. And for most of the Christmas holidays, it was doing exactly that, and it was not normally as quiet as it usually really is when it comes to the news side of things because of the government shutdown.
Mm-hmm. So now, what effect has the U.S. government shutdown had on the markets?
Well, there's quite a few things. Normally at this time of year, I remember just back at the start of December or even just at the end of November, talking to Chicago traders just before the American Thanksgiving holiday, everyone was like, oh, it's almost like party time. Everything just really shuts down. Nobody wants to work in December after Thanksgiving. However, this year, down in the U.S., they didn't get that break. Well, unless you're a government employee and you're not getting paid. Mm-hmm. So the government shutdown, of course, started right before Christmas on the 21st of December. And because of that, just things that happened all the time that nobody thinks of stopped happening. So in the commodity market side of things, suddenly all this information, Americans are really lucky when it comes to the information they get from the USDA. They get a lot of different weekly reports and stuff, and that's how they keep track of the comings and goings on in regards to exports and a lot of other stuff with the U.S. Ag world. So a lot of these reports that we get every week, the weekly exports, stopped coming out. So now we're in the midst of this trade war with China. And China, of course, came to that kind of ceasefire agreement with the U.S. at the end of November, where they were going to do a 90-day truce and try to sort out a deal between the U.S. and China. And one of the things that China said they would do is purchase more U.S. soybeans. So we were getting news of that, of course, before from the USDA, but then the government shutdown happened. And now it's all just rumors. So we think there's loads of reports coming out, and people think that all of this, these purchases are happening, but there's no way to confirm it since the USDA is shut down.
Mm-hmm. I saw there was a bit of a jump in soybeans yesterday, just on the idea that that China was believed to have purchased some soybeans. And of course, nobody's got an exact number to put to that.
No, and the thing is, once this government shutdown ends, then we are going to get a lot of information at once. We're probably going to be bombarded quite a bit once they can kind of get stuff back in process again, and the market's going to react. The market's the soybean market's been building itself up, thinking that all these purchases are happening, and if there hasn't been nearly as many purchases as traders think have been happening, there's going to be a crash.
Mm-hmm. And I gather, too, that that's also where some larger traders, such as the ABCD companies, for instance, are at a bit of an advantage here, because they know if they've been making large deals, they know about it, of course, but the general public isn't getting that information as they usually would.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a big market player market right now, and not so much information-wise the smaller guys.
Mm-hmm. So now you mentioned before that canola, of course, usually follows the leader when it comes to the soy complex. But what's driven canola lately to break out of that follow the leader pattern?
Well, last week we had a bit of an excitement day because a lot of things we've been sitting around, no news really coming out. And then Apple dropped a big report saying that they weren't selling as many phones as they were expected to, which then sent all the equity market traders in the U.S. into a tizzy. And they all kind of left the equity markets and went over to the commodity markets, as they always do whenever things like this happen, because they thought that this report from Apple meant that the global economy is slowing down. So normally you think, oh, hey, this is going to send everything up. But canola, there is a one thing that influences canola that doesn't influence the U.S. commodity market, and that's the value of the Canadian dollar.
Yes.
So when there is a lot of when the commodity markets shoot up, it normally boosters the prices of gold and oil, which are huge influence drivers on the value of the Canadian dollar. So when that happened, the U.S. dollar was going down, equity markets were going down, but commodity markets were shooting up. And the one thing that did also go up was the Canadian dollar, because of those commodity markets going up. So then because of that, that actually sent canola down, which wasn't the most happy thing in the world, but it sent it down, unlike soybeans, because whenever the Canadian dollar is worth more, commodities are normally sold in American dollars, so it makes it it makes canola less attractive to international buyers, because it's worth more on the international marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, since it's winter up here in the Great White North, of course, nothing's growing. What's going on down in South America, where we're in the middle of their summer right now?
Yeah, that's the other thing that's been driving the market lately, of course, as it usually does. So that's the one thing that we can count on to influence the market at this time of year, because it is summer down in South America. So we're seeing a lot of reports. For months, we were seeing reports that Brazil is going to have a record soybean crop. However, they've been getting a lot of dry weather. And now there's a lot of reports coming out from the South American nation there over the holiday season that the crop's going to be reduced. Although I am still hearing reports and rumors that it will be above normal, but not the record crop. And then on the flip side of things, in Argentina, another big ag nation down there, they're actually experiencing too much water. They've been getting a lot of rain, and that might reduce their crop too. So that's been also propping up the soybean complex in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So those will certainly be some of the facts that we can keep an eye on, as well as along with the rumors that traders are having to follow these days as well. And we'll look forward to seeing more of that in the coming weeks. Ashley, thanks for being on Between the Rows.
Thanks for having me.
Ashley Robinson reports for Commodity News Service Canada. That's all we have for this episode, but we'll be back next week with more stories from the Glacier Farm Media Network of Publications. Happy New Year to all. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard.
Today's program was brought to you in part by the Acceleron BioAg brand. Acceleron BioAg products harness the powerful technology of nature to release soil-bound nutrients, helping promote nutrient availability at the plant root. Accelerate crop performance with powerful bioenhancers aimed at promoting nutrient and water uptake and improved yield potential. Nature, it's powerful technology. Always read and follow label directions.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.